You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy?
I'm a human being, God damn it! My life has value!
It's time to ask yourself what you believe.
Mass murder, torture, perjury, embezzlement, fraud, deception, treason. These are just a few of your many crimes against humanity. You will not win this war, for you are fighting the very essence of humanity.
Hi, welcome to Truth or Talk. I'm April Bowden.
I'm Ruthine Henry.
Please check out our website at truthortalk.com. You can find archive shows, our essays, our store. We have a small store with the shirts and Liam Sheff's book. We also have a campaign to support the Dortch family if you have a chance to check that out. It's just a family, a friend. They are being harassed by the police state. So anyone wants to look at it, they can click on it and listen to the radio show they did with the Gnostic Media podcast and find out what's going on with them. Let's see if there's any way you can support them. So, hey, what's up, girl? What you doing?
Nothing. I'm interested to meet our guests. I always love that we have people that are not in America. I mean, I love we have people in America, too, but it's interesting to see other people's points of view from other parts of the world. I mean, you know, yeah, that's what I'm trying to say, other people's point of view from other parts of the world.
Yeah, our next guest is Ole Damagord. His website, Light on Conspiracies, is at lightonconspiracies.com, and we encourage everyone to go check it out, see what kind of research he's been doing. He's well known for doing a lot of heavy research on the Swedish Prime Minister, the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister, Do you know what I'm talking about?
Olaf Palme. I think it's
Olaf Palme. Sorry. Excuse me. Yes. And I felt like all of a sudden I had it in my head and just Olaf Palme. And he, Swedish Prime Minister Olaf Palme, and he found that he, once he started researching it, he was able to connect it to the JFK assassination and Robert Kennedy assassination. And it's like all these people, and it was the same players every single time. And once he started going down the rabbit hole, even the same, like, assassins that they used, to these trained assassins to kill him. So we're going to ask him about that. But, you know, we did a show on JFK assassination not that long ago, so we're going to try and, you know, get him to talk about that just a little bit, maybe a few of the other assassinations that he's investigated, the false flags and whatnot, because we did a show not that long ago on JFK with the one and only Jim Myers. It was awesome. And so that was a good one. I don't know if we can top that, but we will try with Ole Damagord. So, yeah, so I'm looking forward to talking to them. Christine?
Yeah. No. yeah, I mean, he's very, he's going to be very interesting. I want to know if he knows anything about John Lennon and Bob Marley. You know, they were assassinated. I've heard, you were talking about John Lennon being assassinated by the being shot, right? Mark David Chapman, he was shot, right? Because I was a kid when that happened. I think that was the 80s. I was like four, so you must have been like 11? No.
I feel like I was younger than that. I was seven.
Okay, seven, sorry.
Yeah, I was seven when that happened. I remember being a little kid and not really fully understanding, like going to school the next day, and it was one of those things where it was like, oh, did you hear that guy died? But like not even really knowing who it was.
Mm.
And but my parents being very upset and crying and you know, being very emotional about hearing about it and shocked and all of that. So so our next guest has done some research on, you know, these assassinations. He's kind of tied into the assassination of John Lennon. And Bob Marley, the official story was not that he was assassinated. See, John Lennon, we know he was assassinated because everybody saw it, but we know he was shot, but it's just the official story is in question. So how, whether or not it was Mark David Chapman or whether or not Mark David Chapman was the only assassin, we don't, is kind of, I think, in question. But as far as Bob Marley, the official story was that he had an infection on his toe. Like, he went
for toe cancer, yeah.
And then he died? Like, it was really bizarre. It was, it's not that he was, the official story is not that he was assassinated, but the official story is very strange.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind
and
of,
there were people that wanted him dead. You know, he wanted peace. Anybody that tries to bring people together is a threat. So.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Exactly.
And then do you get frustrated sometimes? Do you have people say, well, can't people just die? Why does it always have to be a conspiracy when somebody famous dies? You know, one of those people.
Right.
I think it's just, you kind of start to see the official story that you're told, and then you start to ask questions, and the answers that you get don't make sense. And
plus,
it just seems to be a pattern with people that like to bring people together. You know, they get killed and murdered, I should say.
You know, or say, I mean, exactly. I mean, I think that once you go down the rabbit hole, you realize it is that much, and it's almost like that's part of how they keep it hidden from us, is because it's too much, so then people start to think things like that. Well, there's no way that these can all be conspiracies. So, yes, maybe JFK was, you know, because I don't know anyone who really fully believes the official story of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Well, I mean, at this point, I think that has been pretty much blown out of the water with the famous Oliver Stone film that our guest, Jim Mars, he wrote the book that movie was based on. And that with that film, I think a lot of people sort of went, yeah, there's too many holes. At least the official story is crap. That we know. But as far as who did it and who the players were and stuff like that, we don't exactly know. Although Jim Mars did say that he felt that there were some people who could be held accountable, for instance, Lyndon B. Johnson, because they did know, if not, they were an accessory after the fact. So there, and I thought it was cool. I was like, ooh, name names. Give it to us. Yeah, take those people down. He said that there were some people, they knew after the fact. I mean, you know, they at least, they knew, because they were part of the cover-up. So, you know, how could they not know if they were a part of it? But anyway, I digress. But the various details, getting caught up in the little details, we don't exactly know. But we do know that the official story is full of holes. And I'm sure that, you know, our next guest can talk a little bit more about that. But we were kind of curious about these other things. Because I can't say that I've done all that much research on the assassination of John Lennon or the death of Bob Marley and things like that. So I don't know. I mean, he also has on his website, he talks about other people. Martin Luther King, which I think that's pretty much mainstream news. I mean, not that is widely spread mainstream news, but I think that it was at one point determined in a civil lawsuit that there was a conspiracy to murder him by the U.S. government. So, and that was proven that the U.S. government was found to be guilty for conspiring to murder him.
You know, his family has come out and said that they don't believe that James Earl Ray killed Martin Luther King, too.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I'm sure that they checked it out and went, this is total crap. You know, and he did, there was a sense of that people wanted to kill him. And I don't know if Ole has done research on Malcolm X. I think he has, actually. I think it's on his website, but I don't see anything under it. But anyway,
same kind of pattern as far as trying to bring people together, because he was separatist at first, but when he came back from Mecca, he wanted people to, he apologized and took his stance back, and he was a threat because he was so powerful and he had so many, you know, he was preaching the message of unity.
Yeah, he started to break away. I think he was the Nation of Islam in that moment in time was sort of using him because he was charismatic and he was able to bring a great following. And then it started to become where it was almost like cult-like. This is at least, I mean, from what I understand, and I've read a little bit about this, but I've also, take some of this from with a grain of salt because it was from the movie Malcolm X by Spike Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And so, have you ever seen that?
I saw it a long time ago, but yeah.
And they allude to that. I remember the Nation of Islam is who was accused of assassinating Malcolm X, but they allude to the fact that there could have been a greater conspiracy because Malcolm X did confide in some people before his death that he felt that he was being followed by the FBI and that he was being harassed. He was being harassed, that we know for sure. By whom we don't exactly know, but he did feel that there was a that it wasn't just the Nation of Islam. He thought that there were people within that organization that maybe had turned on him and were trying to sell him out to the intelligence community, the FBI, the CIA, and that somebody was plotting to assassinate him. Now he thought that someone was going to try and kill him, and they actually. I think there were attempts on his life before, and eventually he did get killed. So Ole, our next guest, has written a few books, and you can find him on his website at lightonconspiracies.com, where he talks about the connections between some of these assassinations, which once you go down the rabbit hole and you do see... you don't necessarily know all the gory details, but you do see a pattern that's similar.
Yes, exactly.
And that's where you can sort of start to go, oh, well, that makes sense to me that maybe he's right, that there's, you know, it could be the same people because why do they do the same kind of, you know, the same kind of MO every time, you know? Yes. Or it's like some MK Ultra guy, like with the Mark David Chapman who assassinates John Lennon but then doesn't remember that he did it like 10 minutes later.
Yeah.
And the same thing with Sirhan Sirhan, who assassinated Robert Kennedy, goes the official story. He didn't remember it either. So you kind of go, well, what do these guys remember doing anything? And then, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald, who was the official story that he assassinated JFK, he just outright said he didn't do it. He said he was a patsy. So, I believe him.
Yeah.
I don't think he was necessarily a good guy. He was tied to CIA and intelligence, but did he assassinate John Kennedy or have anything to do with it? I doubt it. I think if he did have anything to do with it, it was very loosely and peripherally, but did he shoot him?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think so. So, it was, I doubt it highly. And, you know, that's one of the things that, that was one of the first kind of, like, conspiracies I became aware of. I don't know about you, but when I was, I think I saw that movie when I was, like, 19 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I first learned that the JFK movie, that my dad was into that shit, like, when he was younger.
Mm-hmm.
That he had been, he was a truther, or at least in that regard, I never knew growing up. I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But then by the time I was an adult, a young adult, like 18, 19 years old, and that movie came out, and we went and saw it. I was still living with my parents, and we went to see it, and afterwards we stayed up until like 2 in the morning talking about the JFK assassination, and I found out that my dad had been one of those, like, that was like, researching it and going, oh, yeah, it couldn't have been Lee Harvey Oswald because of these reasons, and this is pre-internet.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, I don't know where
he probably went to the library, oh my god.
Yeah, he went to the library and he was like looking up old newspapers.
What's
and stuff,
that?
You know? And he did think that, you know, he did believe in the official story, and, you know, he wasn't the only one. I mean, he and his friends would have, you know, talks about it and who was controlling the world at the time, you know, and who possibly wanted Kennedy dead, and also then when, of course, Robert Kennedy was assassinated as well, they said, well, there it is, you know, there's a conspiracy. Somebody is trying to take certain people out, because then they can, it's not just that they want to take these people out, they want to overthrow the government and put in their own people. And so that's how they start doing it, they start taking out the big players. And,
it's like chess. So, it's a big old game of chess.
Exactly, exactly. And so, anyway, but that's, I digress, because our next guest can certainly talk on all of this stuff a lot better than I. He's done years and years and years of research on it and has several books about it. So we are going to take a short break, and when we get back, we'll be talking to Ole Demagogue of Light on Conspiracies. So stay with us, folks.
Hello, thanks for having me on your radio. Even though we're not from a famous rock and roll band, if we were, even though we sound a little like we are, we'd definitely wear a Conspiracy Realist t-shirt, because they're gear, aren't they? Oh yeah, they're really gear. I want to write a song about them. Conspiracy Realist t-shirts at truthatease.com. I got to think of the middle eight. Shop.truthatease.com. What does that mean? It's the internet. What's that? I don't know. It's a net. It's between things. Shop.truthatease.com. What's that? It's where you get Conspiracy Realist t-shirts. Oh, gear.
Welcome back to Truth or Talk. On today's show, we are talking to Ole Demagogue. Ole is a prize-winning author and has written several books. He's an investigator, former journalist, and more. For more than 30 years, he has worked very hard on solving the mystery behind the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. Something that has not turned out to be, or that has turned out to be a very dangerous task and has cost the lives of some dear friends. Not only does he humbly believe that he has managed to solve one of the century's biggest murder mysteries, his extensive research has also revealed incredible links to other political events, like the killing of JFK, John Lennon, Robert Kennedy, Che Guevara, Salvador Allende, Pablo Neruda, and many others, as well as the cold-blooded sinking of M. Estonia, taking almost 1,000 innocent lives. Please welcome to the show, Ole Demagogue. Hello, Ole. Good morning. How are you? Or good evening.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good afternoon. You're welcome.
You're welcome. And then, Ole, you, your website is lightonconspiracies.com, and your most recent book is Coup d'etat in Slow Motion, correct?
That is correct, yeah.
Yeah, I would recommend that everybody go and sign up for your newsletter, because you put out a lot of good stuff, and I've also I'm on your Facebook page, so that's also a good way to keep in touch with you, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it's Light on Conspiracies that there as well. Conspiracies, like plural.
Light on.
There's a lot of conspiracies going on, I tell you.
But there are a lot of connections between them as well, so that's what's unique about what you do, is that you kind of, you're able to see how these things are all interconnected and related, which, you know, sometimes people miss the bigger picture, they compartmentalize these things, but you have a really good grasp on that. So I recommend that anybody listening go and check that out, lightonconspiracies.com, and his Facebook page as well, if you're on Facebook or whatever social networking. You're on all of them, right? Just like us.
So,
yeah, as many as possible, right? There's too many out there. But I
want to
go ahead and...
You know, I listened to a former MI6 agent a while ago, and he explained the meaning of the word paranoid. The correct word, the correct meaning, as far as he explained, was that it's the ability to see when things are connected, that an ability that nobody else sees. You know, that they cannot see these events being interlinked. And if that is the case, I feel proud of calling myself paranoid, because I managed to connect a lot of these big major mysteries and linking them back to the same small elite group, or they call themselves the elite, the so-called global elite. And what I also found during almost 30 years of research is that not only is it the same power group behind the JFK assassination, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Che Guevara, the Watergate, Iran-Contras, 9/11, and so on. It's the same group with some rogue elements moving in and out, but they've also used the same team of assassins to a great extent. And this is what I specialize, trying to find out exactly what they've been up to because these people have been very, very active for decades. So that's my background, type of.
And so why don't you start off by telling us how you started becoming an investigative? Because would you consider yourself an investigative journalist? Like, if that's what you do, and how did you start making these investigations?
I grew up in a family in Denmark where my family was very active during the Second World War when Denmark was occupied by the Nazi army, the Nazi occupation. And so I grew up with all these stories about how important it is to stand up for what is true and right, even though you're Mr. Absolute Nobody, and that you're the only, that you're only one, you know, that, but you still have to do what is right. My granddad did these things. He ended up in jail for helping Jews, and my dad was in the resistance movement. My grandmother's sister helped smuggling weapons in baby cots and so on. So I don't know how, it was somehow I got it with me from childhood and so on. Then, wow. When I was, one of my first jobs was as a journalist, so during that job I started learning how to ask questions and also not buying into the official version every single time that I'm being fed it, but also to listen to what is not said, you know, how people avoid answering questions or the way they say things, but where there's a hidden sentence in between, you know. So it gave me, I'm very grateful for that because it has helped me to you know, track down lies and find out what they're trying to hide and so on. Then in the early 1980s, I started becoming almost obsessed with the JFK assassination, and it was very clear after not very long that we were being fed absolute lies, the same lies that we're being fed to this very day. And so I think I read a couple of hundred books about the JFK assassination, and then that in turn led me into the Robert Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, all the way, you know, Abraham Lincoln, and actually all the way back to the Roman killings, you know, because many of these assassinations are done by templates, I think, that was invented by the Romans, you know, how to commit a political assassination on a top level and how to dupe the population into thinking that it was the deed of a lone crazy guy when it was actually part of their very brutal agenda, but how to avoid normal people to become aware of it. So, well, I spent, like you said, I spent 30 years not as a journalist because I must say I feel almost a little ashamed of having been a journalist because I think there's very few real journalists left. Most are so stressed, you know, from story to story, being pushed around by the editors, not understanding really what's going on, and so that they focus on very, I would say, kind of stupid things like what Britney Houston or whoever had, some kind of pop star had for breakfast or a football instead of understanding what is going on, because of course that can be of interest as well, but if the country or the community is being taken down by a hidden agenda, you know, big time, then I think, not that I'm into politics at all, I'm just trying to stop criminals, you know, from destroying this beautiful world. So I think it would be a good idea for these journalists to sort of wake up and see, wait a second, maybe I should try and focus on more important stuff. And that is what I did. I quit my job as a journalist, and that's where my real journalistic career started, if you want to say it. Because then I started doing what I believe journalists are supposed to do and what the police are supposed to do, because people like myself have had to do all these murder investigations and so on that have not been carried out the way they should be by normal police and so on, because very often it turns out that the police is actually, I'm not saying the whole police, but rogue elements within the police are part of the cover-up, part of the whole logistics when it comes to an assassination. They supply the killers that are flown in with weapons, vehicles, food, housing, these type of things.
Yeah.
So what? It's
I was going to ask you, what is the state of mind of other people in Europe? Are they, do you find that there are a lot of people that are awake or conscious of the world and how it works from the point of view that you see it?
I tell you, I think now is an absolute wonderful time to be alive. I started out being one of these tinfoil hats or being looked upon, you know, crazy or this type of thing, just because I started waking up to the fact that, my God, we're being fed absolute lies, what is going on, you know. I had absolutely no idea the picture I was about to uncover over all of these years. It was almost like making a jigsaw puzzle, but with the picture side down, you know. I was just trying to get the pieces to fit together, and then the more over the years that started fitting together, the more I could start slowly seeing the picture, the whole picture, you know, and that is a big one. It's a big one. But like I say, I was very alone for many years, but then since the last, I think, 3, 4, 5 years, there's just this amazing booming, you know, of awareness. Going on a global scale, where people are just popping up all over the place, being so aware and so awake suddenly, and so I think it's an absolute wonderful time to be alive, because the decades when these groups have been able to work as a hidden secret government, you know, we haven't had no idea of their agenda or their existence even, and now suddenly the spotlight is being aimed straight at them, saying, we see you. We see the template you're using in the form of so-called terror acts or mass shootings or whatever it is you're trying to pull off to scare us into accepting your agenda. And you can't hide anymore. And this group is getting, I think, extremely worried. That is why they're speeding everything up with all of these, in your country, it's all the mass shootings, because it's your population who is the only armed population. So that is why they try to pull these false flag operations, because they're staged, every single one of them, I would say. All the ones I looked into, absolute staged event, even some of them using actors and, I mean, on a low budget and so sloppily made nowadays. I mean, at least in the old days, you know, with JFK, 9/11 and so on, good budget, lots of time to prepare, you know, good skilled people involved. Now it's just like, you know, it's like in the film industry, let's make Rocky 18, you know, let's do it again, again. Same theme, but different, you know, we need to change the bad guy.
I have a question. Do you think that it's sloppy because you can see more now, because you're more aware of how these things work, and you're like, oh, that's sloppy? Do you think that, you know what I mean? Now you think they're getting, you think that they've gotten sloppier as a result of their arrogance and thinking that, you know, they've been getting away with it for so long, they can just, you know, they don't really have to be as meticulous about planning.
You know, in the old days, even though they knew that they were untouchables, I mean, they would get away with murder, literally. But at that time, in the old days, they put a lot of effort into trying to get the details correct, you know. And that made it very difficult for someone like myself to really find out what was going on. But at the same time, the arrogance of them feeling untouchable also made them do mistakes that no normal crook would do. But now they have it's called the strategy of tension that they used since the early 1960s and onwards, you know, when they inflict terror on a society to get the population to say, oh my God, we need protection. And then they will welcome my Robocop army and, you know, tanks and drones and all of these things. The more terror I can inflict on society, the more normal people will accept for their protection that I move in with the absolute mayhem.
Hegelian dialectic, right?
That's the one. Yeah. Problem, reaction, solution. You're spot on. That is the one they use all the time.
Right.
And when it comes to sloppiness, it's just like now the agenda is they need to do a weekly scare. And if you check out these things, they will come on a weekly, very static, like this week, shooting on the week, where should we go? Oh, go for Seattle, next one. Seattle, where haven't we been? Oklahoma City. No, let's do Las Vegas. Okay, next one will be maybe East Coast. Spread it out, but it's very static, you know. Boom, boom, boom. And then maybe the agenda, because they fear that we will see what's going on before it's too late for them. So they're trying to push us into this, I would say almost like a prison cell, you know, push us in there so that they can get total control of us before it's too late for them, because we will have sussed them out. This is also why I put a lot of effort. I mean, I made, I don't know, hundreds of interviews the last few years, and where I put a lot of effort by explaining the exact templates they are using. You know, this is not templates I found on paper, but I've just seen the patterns of how they pull these things off. And so by exposing the methods and the templates, then people themselves can see the next time a so-called terror act is blamed on a lone patsy, or an assassination is blamed on a lone patsy, or a group like the, I mean, now the, it's the truth seekers are the ones that they have problems with. Or soon it will be the homeless or some group they yes. need to get rid of anyway. So by exposing these templates, then hopefully the spotlight will be stronger and stronger on them, saying, you won't get away with it. We see you. We see yes. what you're up to. So this is why also I urge people, when you hear about drills, upcoming drills, because the drills are nowadays part of the template. You know, they very often have a drill with the exact same scenario as the so-called terror act that they're going to pull off. So in the middle of this drill, suddenly it goes live, and the people involved, many of them don't even know that it's gone live. You know, they think, oh my God, the explosion, and look at the dead bodies. My God, it looks so real. And not understanding that sometimes it's actually is real, like in London when they did that and so on. So
I think that happened in Boston too, the Boston yeah. bombing that happened like last year. It was partly a drill, and some people didn't know that it was real. You know, and then we saw a lot of the pictures that they showed us were actually of the drill, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, as far as I know, it was not even a real event. It was a whole right. the whole thing was set up, you know. Mm-hmm. And this is what you see repeatedly, especially in the U.S. But I must say that I've just come back from the so-called Bilderberg meeting in Copenhagen, and I think I humbly think that I was part of defusing a massive, massive false flag operation there right outside the hotel. I can go into some details if you're interested, because that could have been a major blow globally, I tell you.
Yeah, sure. You were at the Bilderberg recently in Copenhagen?
Yeah, I was invited up there from the Truth Movement in Denmark. So I was one of the key speakers, together with Luke Rudovsky and Dan Dix from Canada and so on. But the thing was that when I came there, you know, the Bilderberg group, for the listeners who might not be aware of this group, they are part of this hidden global government, I would call them. They've been around since 1954, when they were created in Holland, in Hotel Bilderberg. That's why they've chosen this name. They might as well call themselves the Oompa Loompa group or something like that, but they chose the Bilderberg group. And what the agenda with this was to have a steering committee that would invite people from all different countries, NATO countries and Western countries mostly, to pick out key people in key positions from every single country, so that they can control them without the population being aware of it. And a country that, you know, like the size of Sweden or Germany or Denmark, you know, like with 15 to 25 people, but in the key position, you can control that country more or less, you know, push it. This is like people in media, the royal families, the bankers, business, you name it, communication, military intelligence, Google, these type of people. When you get the key people in there, then you can more or less push the world in your agenda, in the direction you want it. And this is why the last 200 pages of my book, Coup d'Etat in Slow Motion, it's almost 1,100 pages long, I tell you, because it's so intricate and so connected with so many of the other conspiracies that looks like they're separated, but I tell you, they all hang together. And these 200 pages are just membership lists, and also the agenda that has been leaked out, and the locations where they've been meeting, because every year they meet in different locations, super secret, and it's only, I think it was 2013, was the first year they couldn't deny that the group actually existed. And then 2014, they went totally open and said, more or less open, and said, we're going to meet in Copenhagen. So I went up there, I flew in from Spain, and I went there. And the thing was that normally they don't want anyone to look in or have any knowledge of what's going in there. So normally they have the massive security, you know, police, armed police, military, helicopters around, snipers on the roofs, bomb sniffing dogs, the whole shebang. And very often the hotel is quite isolated and with no possibility to look in for normal people and so on. So this year when I came there, I thought, okay, it's going to be like it is normally. I asked to be driven straight to the hotel, and when I came there, there was absolute zero security. And this was just like 12 hours before it was supposed to the first members were supposed to arrive, because there's about 140 members that was invited to this meeting. And this hotel is not like they normally are, isolated, and so it's right in the middle of central Copenhagen, by the side of a big water canal, and then surrounded by insurance companies, banks, and the police headquarters right in front of the building as well. But in between the headquarters and the hotel, there's a main street and a big open area that is normally used as a parking for the police and so on. That was had been fenced in for the truth movement to get everyone in there. But like, it was so odd, because when I went around there, there was, like I said, no security. There was only two police officers. That was it. And no bomb-sniffing dogs, no military, no helicopters, no nothing. So I got a very strange feeling, because I thought, my God, these people, they've got top-of-the-line security people, you know. They got military intelligence, the whole everything at their hands. So why on earth would they choose a hotel like this? And I noticed, like, because we were only a handful of people there, even though it was in central Copenhagen, very, very few people. And they had started building like a concrete wall around the hotel to put fence up and so on. But absolutely no one. And it was so that we could even walk up to the building and look in through, because the whole building is made of glass, so you can look in through the corridors and the staircase and so on. Absolutely not the way it normally is. So I thought, since these people are not stupid, why would they choose this hotel? So I started looking from a different angle, and option one was quite clear, that maybe they're using this hotel as a decoy, you know, to get the whole truth movement in a fenced-in area so that they can control them, and at the same time they can meet in a different hotel somewhere, luxury, blah, blah, blah. Maybe even in another country, or a castle or something, or an army base, you know. Decoy was the one thing. But then the more I looked at it, I suddenly got this very eerie feeling, because if you're used to look at false flag operations, which I have spent decades doing, they have a very, very specific way of setting it up, and the choice of location, the choice of the buildings around, the choice of the building they intend to blow up and so on. There's all of it are following a template again. And suddenly when I looked at this area, I thought, oh my God, oh my God, this could be the perfect scenario for a false flag massacre, really, to knock out the truth movement. Because back to the old Roman tactic, problem, reaction, solution. They secretly create a problem to blame someone, you know, in this case it would be the truth movement, to get the reaction from the population. In this case it will go globally, and the reaction would be if there was a bomb here killing people inside the hotel, their reaction would be, oh my God, something needs to be done. And then they would come with a solution saying, my God, this truth movement, here they are saying they're peace-loving people, you know, and look what they've done. They massacred this poor little elite group that was only meeting for a nice cup of coffee and a chat, you know. And in that blow, they could just demand, you know, that now, because of this awful massacre, we need to ban all rights to demonstrate, ban all rights to protest, ban all rights to meet in big groups. That could also be used to as a way to restrict the internet, because the whole truth movement is working with the internet, you know, to censor the internet due to this thing and so on. So when I looked around and I suddenly saw the possibility of this being carried out, I went straight home. I called a former whistleblower, a friend of mine. His name is Chip Tatum. You can check him out on chiptatum.com. He's a former deep cover CIA agent for 25 years, a black op assassin. He's a Night Stalker pilot. He was one of the pilots in the Iran-Contras, you know, drugs in, weapon out. And he was also he was the commander of George Bush Sr.'s team of assassins called Pegasus. So, I mean, this is not an amateur, not a beginner in any way. I called him and I said, listen, I feel very eerie about this. Could you just, you know, I don't want to be paranoid and start spreading fear, but could you just check it out? He said, please describe the whole thing. I described it like I did to you. He said, my God, it's a very, very, there's a very clear possibility of this being a possible setup. So he said, get out, be aware of the, you know, it could be parking meters that doesn't fit in, or packages, or cables, or something like that, that would be placed in the truth, in the area for the truth movement. Because I can just go into how this whole thing would be set up. If it was, I'm not saying 100% that it was, but I got it confirmed by Chip Tatum, I got it confirmed by another whistleblower, Stu Webb. I got it confirmed by a former Marine and a professor called Jim Fetzer. So I felt quite secure in my analyze, the way I
understood. Analyst, you're right, yeah. Sorry.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because the way it would be set up for a possible false flag would be the building surrounding the parking lot are insurance companies and banks owned by members in the elite. So they control these buildings. Then the police headquarters, also controlled by them. The hotel itself, if they were if it followed the template, you know, of these terror acts, there would be some kind of problem with this hotel. Maybe a crack in the foundation due to it being right on the bank of this river, or it could be asbestos in the foundation. Something, a major problem with that building. So there would be a big expense to get it repaired. So that would be the reason they would blow it up, blame it on a patsy, and then collect billions in insurance. So if this would be true, then it would be possible to, by checking the insurance policies, you would see that a week or two before this event, there would be a change suddenly including terror acts in this insurance. This is standard when it comes to these things. Okay, so what I would do, if I was the one planning it, I would send in some limos with doubles, you know, put on some fancy hairdo and say you're Queen Beatrix, these type of things, because people could not get close, so you could just get like a 2-second glimpse of someone. You'd get some doubles in the hotel. The rest of the hotel is totally empty, but packed with explosives on the inside, just like in Oklahoma City or in Oslo when they pulled that one off. Okay, so you got the hotel charged, you got the whole truthmen packed in a fenced-in area controlled by local police who do not know what is about to happen, you know. What you need to is, you would need, like, hopefully for them, like 1,000 or 2,000 people in that, because you need to stir the energy, you know. You can't have a quiet crowd for a thing like this. So if they weren't agitated already, you would send in a group of provocateurs, maybe a handful, you know, would be enough. These people would start shouting, throwing things, maybe a Molotov cocktail or two. And if that wouldn't be enough, then another part of this provocateur team would dress up in Danish police uniforms and then arrest someone, who would also be one of the provocateurs, drag him in front of the whole fenced-in area, right in front of the whole crowd, you know, totally innocent. This guy would be screaming, maybe they would hit him or something like that. So the whole crowd would go wild, you know, like, let him go, let him go. And then once that whole thing was going, then suddenly, boom, out you blow the whole front of the hotel. It lands on top of the truth movement, killing people, blowing them to pieces, but not hitting any of the surrounding buildings because it's totally open, and if you aim the explosion in a correct way, it will just go straight forward, yeah? And then right away in media, you would pump out these horrific images of blown up people, you know, and all of this. You would have aerial photo as well with helicopters. You would have photos from teams in the building surrounding them, the whole place, so that you have all different angles. And a team in the street level with a wide angle covering both the truth movement and the front of the hotel, so you could get all of that on film. So what I did when I got it confirmed by Chip and the other people that my suspicion could be right, you know, I'm not saying it is, I'm just saying that there was a lot of things aiming in that direction. So what I did was I went out on a handful of the international radio stations. I spent like until 4 a.m. in the morning, you know, going New Zealand, Canada, U.S., England, Germany, all of that, just pumping it out, getting the radio host to say, to record the date and time when this information was spread out, so that if it happened, God forbid, if it hadn't, that it would be recorded that this was not a work of the truth movement. It would be an inside job blaming it on it. But even more important, to defuse the whole thing for them. You know, if this was the plan set up to just, by getting the info out there beforehand, then saying, we got the spotlight right on you. If you pull that trigger, if you pull it, we know who you are. We know what you're up to, you know.
That is a very smart thing to do.
Thank
you. I just did my absolute best, you know. And do you know, in the next morning when I came there, the newspaper said that there were 2,000 to 3,000 protesters there. Mm-hmm. There was only a handful. Where did that number come from? Do you know, because very often in these false flags, they leak out information beforehand, making whoever they're going to make the patsy, make them, you know, painting them like the boogeyman. So where did that number come from? Also, when I came to the area, I was one of the first there, 8 o'clock in the morning or something like that. Somebody had placed a massive pentagram made by train sleepers right in the area where the truth movement was supposed to gather. I mean, can you imagine an aerial photo, like the whole explosion, smoke, bombs, dead bodies, and right in the middle of the truth movement, a pentagram? Can you see that interesting spread?
I can. Actually,
I know that, yeah.
You know, I just want to switch gears a little bit too, because I know that you're a musician, right?
Yeah.
You're a musician, and I saw you in one interview. You talk about the power of music, and how when militia take over a country, the first thing they do is go after the poets, the artists, the writers, the musicians, and the actors. And I thought that was really, really interesting, because I remember when I was in college and I was taking some black history courses, I was taught that whenever forces were to go into a country, even like back in the old days, that was the first thing that they would do. They would go and they would take over the religion of the people, their art and their music and things like that, because they found that they were easier to control spiritually. And I feel like, you know, one of the ways people, because you just talked about Bilderberg and how they're really good at, you know, how and that they're, you know, manipulators, right? So it seems like these people are very manipulative. They know how to manipulate situations, but they're not really good at creating things. So I feel like also one of the ways, main ways people in positions of power are able to manipulate us is because they've infiltrated the arts through Hollywood. So would you care to comment on how powerful the arts are to humanity?
I think it's one of the most beautiful things we have, and it's the thing that creates dreams and visions and hope and you know, inner power. And this is what they fear. You know, this is, just like you say, this is not a new thing. You just study history and you will see it's been going on for ages. And the first group they hit, boom, the poets, you know, a poem can be so, so powerful. A speech, I mean, listen to Martin Luther King's speech, these type of speeches, and JFK, my God, they're bigger than the person, you know. And songs like Victor Jara in Chile, you know, these type of songs that they live long beyond the person is dead. So yeah. One of the things that they fear is the arts. And at the same time, what they also fear is to create martyrs. Because if they create a martyr, then that person, you know, once they kill him, he becomes a bigger threat to them. You know, like Martin Luther King, for instance, when the second he died, whoever he was before that, he became a saint. JFK,
yeah.
Before he died, one thing, after he died, boom, a saint. Olof Palme, before he died, one thing, after he died, boom, a saint. You know, so they fear these saints. They fear them. And
John Lennon.
Also, John Lennon is another one. Lady Di is another one.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Mahatma Gandhi is another one.
Yeah.
So this is... yes, you're very, very correct in seeing the pattern of them aiming at the art, you know, knocking them out, or take over the control of them. And this is what they've done now in a very sad way in Hollywood and the music business as well. The last 20 years, it's just an absolute takeover. And the people they don't need anymore, they get rid of. And if they can get rid of them in a way so they can make billions, they do it. A very brutal, brutal agenda.
You know, you talked about how they use patsies and stuff, and since we're segueing into the music industry, when you were researching the John Lennon assassination, do you believe that Mark David Chapman was possibly an MK Ultra victim?
Totally. He had nothing to do with it. Absolutely nothing. He was just the chosen guy. These patsies are, every single time, they're totally innocent. Sirhan, you know, Robert Kennedy,
yeah.
Mark Chapman, there's so many of them, and they're rotting away in jail because we're so asleep, not waking up to the fact is what's going on, and then get them out of there because, my God, these people are nothing. They've done nothing except being in the wrong place at the right time.
You also mentioned that in the John Lennon assassination that there were there was evidence of a second shooter, and so can you talk about that a little?
Yes, if it's okay if I rewind a little.
Sure.
In the early or the late 1950s, early 1960s, President Dwight Eisenhower approved of a plan to put together a team of highly skilled assassins that could be used globally to be sent out, under the control of the CIA to take out whoever they had problems with. And this was not, the idea of this did not come from Eisenhower. It was the former CIA or the CIA director, Alan Dulles, who was very central in many, many of these atrocities, and other people from the CIA who... put together this idea, and the man who was put in charge of making it real was the Vice President Richard Nixon. Now, Richard Nixon used some hardened veterans from the CIA, and what they did was they recruited mostly exiled Cubans in Miami that was trained in everything from jungle warfare to blowing up things to all types of assassinations and so on. And this group that they created was called Operation 40 or Group 40. And the paymaster for this group, not the guy who paid himself, but the guy that funneled the funds into this group to be used globally, was a man by the name of George Herbert Walker Bush, George Bush Sr.
Oh, God.
And his father, Prescott Bush, was doing exactly the same thing, but doing the funding of Adolf Hitler's war machine. You know, so we're talking about the same group of people going way back in history. Now, when you start looking into the members of this Operation 40, these assassins, it is mind-blowing what these people have been up to. Because when you track these members and their deeds, hideous deeds, they're just all over the place. And they were in Dealey Plaza. They were a major part of the shooters there. I can go into great details about all the people involved, the location, who and so on. A major part of the shooters and spotters and breakdown guys were from Operation 40. People were taking part of the killing of Robert Kennedy, some of them Operation 40. The Watergate burglars, Operation 40. And Also, 23 years later, after the JFK assassination, some of the people in Stockholm, when Olof Palme was taken out, was connected to Operation 40.
Wow.
You know, and it goes on and on. Robert Smith in South Africa, Uwe Barschel in Germany, Salvador Allende in Chile, you know, so many. Orlando Letier, they blew up in Washington, D.C. in the car bomb, Operation 40. But now we come to John Lennon. The evening when John Lennon was shot, he was just about to make his big comeback, you know, and he was just in the middle of planning a big peace tour, going, I think, at first in the States, and then it was going to go global. And the problem that this so-called global elite, I call them the lightless or the minority, because they're such a small group that it's an absolute joke that we're letting them get away with this for such a long time. But the thing that they fear is the truth and peace, because they are behind a very, very brutal death machine that is just spreading death, terror, and destruction all over the globe. I tell you, these people are behind so much of all of these atrocities that make us think that the world is crazy. It's not. There's a small bully terrorizing the neighborhood, you know. And it's only by us being asleep that they get away with it. So anyway, back to John Lennon. He was just about to make his comeback, and he arrived from the studio together with Yoko. They arrived in a limo. And Mark Chapman, the guy who was blamed for the assassination, he was standing to the right when they got out of the limo. Yoko started entering the building, and John followed like 5-6 meters afterwards. A series of shots were fired, and John Lennon was hit, falling down, fatally wounded, started crawling into the building, but died while being taken to the hospital and so on. Now, if you look at the crime scene, I always approach a crime scene with what I call Farmer Brown logic. You know, 1 + 1 = 2. If anyone tries to persuade me that it's 72, they're lying, and there's a reason why they lie. And if you track that down, why they lie, you will find the real motive, you know. And so when John Lennon was shot, was he shot from the angle where Mark Chapman was standing, which would be from the back and to the right? No, he was hit straight from the left, and some of the bullets were so close that they almost had the same hole of entrance, you know. So who was standing to the left, I would say, being Farmer Brown? This very evening, the doorman there was a former CIA operative by the name of Jose Perdomo. He was only mentioned as the doorman for quite a while, but then later his real identity came out. And this Jose Perdomo, for 10 years, he was one of the highest ranking officers in Operation 40. Now you go figure, how big are the chances of one of the top assassins being right in a position where the shots were fired from? And then it's a totally brain-dead person who has no experience in shooting, who has no motive, who has known nothing, who is standing like an absolute zombie just waiting to be picked up. You know, highly skilled assassin, brain-dead individual. What do you think? Without a motive, with no reason. You know, so this is the thing, just crack them, pull it apart, you know. See what's going on, see the template they're using, and just look at the evidence. What did the witnesses see? If there's an explosion in one place, everything from the epicenter would be where the explosives were. But in most of these false flag operations, we're being told that, oh, the bomb was placed here by this crazy guy. Well, the explosion came from inside the building, so that really tells you straight away that something wrong is going on.
Have you come across any evidence on Michael Jackson being an MK Ultra victim? Because I think also because he was in the industry so young, that he was a good candidate for that.
I'm the wrong one to ask. I have not gone into that case that much.
Okay.
I would say though that if you look at his actions the last year he was alive, when he suddenly started, you know, charging and going straight right against the Sony top, that,
yeah,
I think was when he signed his own death penalty or whatever you want to call it. because he was going very, very strong, and you know, in a very powerful way, he was trying to expose them. And this is the thing: if you're just a Mr. Nobody and you're just blabbing along, nobody listens. But if you're someone like Michael Jackson, Lady Diana, John Lennon, suddenly your word have impact on billions of people, you know, and that's when they become a threat, and that's why they're eliminated.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a sad, sad story, you know, sad, and it keeps repeating if we can't stop it. So I'll do my utmost, I tell you.
Well, you also talked about some other famous musicians, including Jimi Hendrix, who he was 27 when he died, and there's this famous, like, 27 club. Do you know anything about that, or do you think there's any merit to that, or is it just a myth?
The 27?
Yeah.
There's a lot of people dying at 27. I do not know if it was, it's just, I can see a pattern, but I can't say that it's made on purpose, but very many died at 27. I cannot either prove who was behind the assassination of Jimi Hendrix. What I can say, though, is that he was murdered. He died from... He was drowned in red wine. They held him down and filled his lungs with red wine, you know, pumping it. So when he came, when he was dead on arrival to the hospital, and when they, as soon as they moved him, there was just red wine coming out of nose and mouth and all of these things, but with no alcohol content in the blood, showing that he was not drunk, you know, that this was just being pushed down his throat. Once again, very brutal. But also, this was the first black musician that really suddenly made a massive impact on the music world, and he was starting to talk pro the Black Panthers, pro these type of things. Just being a young guy, not really understanding that he was messing with the big boys, you know, and that he was in shark water, I think. And that got him killed.
You know, it's so funny, John Lennon supported the Black Panthers, too. I was very surprised to hear that, too, and I think that was, you know, that, to them as well.
That the Black Panther supports John Lennon, or...
No, John Lennon, and there's footage of him talking about that he supported the Black Panthers. He was also a supporter. He was, you know, for the Black Panthers as well.
I have no idea. Do you know, it's so easy to put images up there and say things on the internet.
I saw him talking about it on an interview. I'll see if I can find you the interview and send it to you. So it's not like, he was talking about it out of his own mouth, sitting down. I think it was like on the Dick Cavett Show or something like that.
Okay, yeah. I know exactly which one you're talking about. In that case, I mean, I think John Lennon, he was just, you know, anyone who was standing for freedom, but he was supporting, but not the violence behind it. You know,
I think he was talking about his 12-point system and stuff, and you know, a lot of, I think the original Black Panthers, their agenda has been misinterpreted. I think that the modern day Black Panthers maybe aren't as, they're more violent and nonsensical, but the original Black Panthers, you know, they were into defending themselves. They weren't really into, anyway, I'll send you the, that's another show, but I want you to go on, but you know, I'll send you the link.
Excellent. And anytime on any case or assassination, anything you want, I'm always here on standby. That goes for anyone.
Okay.
And the way you describe the death of Jimi Hendrix, or the assassination of Jimi Hendrix, sounds similar to the death of Whitney Houston. I mean, just in the bathtub, and would you say... is there a correlation? Like, is there something symbolic that has to do with drowning people in their bath? Or that's also how Jim Morrison died, too, I think. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
It is when you get into this area. I just want to say, when it comes to Jimi Hendrix, also the witness that was with him, that was sort of like a girlfriend, Monica Dannemann, a German girlfriend of his. There was very strange things around her testimonies and so on around that, and she later died, and she was found dead in a car, you know, having committed suicide. Many people that are connected to these cases, somehow connected, either as witnesses or investigators or journalists, or have a very bad habit of dying very young. So I think around the JFK assassination, I saw the chances of dying young, if you had something to do with the JFK any type of involvement, you know, even if you weren't involved in the killing itself, was 1 trillion higher than a normal person. So it's a dangerous area to go into.
Yeah, I think that was true of Jim Morrison's girlfriend, too. She died like 2 years after.
Oh, wow.
Like I say, there's so many of them. I've had friends who died as well, and I had to leave my country as well because of it. So it's a dangerous thing, dangerous road to walk down. But when it comes to Whitney, very, very tragic and so sinister in the way it was carried out. The thing is that some people are worth more dead than alive to these people. You know, this is
that's what Chaka Khan said.
She said that, and she's not the only one. When your talent is used, you know, when you're going downhill, and they see an opportunity to make a billion with all of these albums, tribute album, or all of these things, and remakes of movies, and when they see a possibility to do that, they go for it sometimes. And Whitney, I believe, was one of them. And the way she was taken out was very... I don't like going into these satanic rituals and things, but there's a lot pointing in that direction.
Oh, yeah, I believe you. I do. I've seen a... I know, like, there was creepy things, like they left the body...
It was the pre-Grammy party, and Clive Davis, who was her manager and the guy that discovered her, sort of, it was his party, and he was at, before she died, because her throat was destroyed, you know, and her whole thing, she was almost 50, the way they saw it, she's worth nothing to us anymore. Well, here's the possibility to kill her in this awful way, and at the same time make absolute billions, which they did. You know, she hadn't even died almost before iTunes and Sony, and then doubled the prices of her albums. I mean, it was like doom, 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 so fast, you know.
Yeah.
And but the official story is that she was staying at the Beverly Hilton Hotel in Los Angeles. And by the way, Los Angeles is one place where there are a lot of these conspiracies are being carried out, and a lot of these assassinations are carried out. And I think because some parts of the police that they control is very corrupt, so they use the same players, you know.
You're right, I live in Los Angeles, born and raised, so
it's a sad place to be when it comes to these things. There's so many strange suicides or killings things behind when it comes to movie stars or athletes or rock stars, you name it, that has been covered up. And many of them are no-brainers, you know, like if you take Robert Kennedy, if Sirhan Sirhan, he has a revolver with 8 bullets in it, and there's up to 30 shots fired. I mean, you don't have to be super smart to say, maybe there was a second shooter, you know? But then straight away you're being called a conspiracy theorist. No, I'm not. I'm just saying, how on earth was he able to pull off 13 shots with a revolver with 8? And did the shots hit Robert Kennedy straight from the front where Sirhan Sirhan was? I mean, he was never closer than a meter, a little more than a meter. Did all 3 shots hit him straight from the front? No, he was hit straight from the back to the right at point-blank range. So, Farmer Brown logic, who was standing there?
Yeah, I know, it's really obvious, but, you know, I was just curious, according to your research, you know, about the assassinations in the music industry, and there's a myth that's kind of going around, or is it a myth that says, in order to be, to reach a high level of fame, that you have to sell your soul to the devil. And I look at some people that have seemed to make it in the industry that don't seem to have sold their soul. Do you think that they're, or am I wrong? Is it possible to be successful artist, musician in the industry without going down that dark road and selling your soul?
I so hope so. I don't know. I don't want to point any fingers. I just know that there's a lot of weird things going on, and some people nowadays, they're so into becoming famous that they're willing to do whatever.
Yeah.
And and the people who are controlling a big part of the industry these days are, they have a very sinister agenda. And these are not people to be recommended to get too close, I would say. So I heard these rumors as well. I have no idea. I really hope they're not true.
And you talked about, in one interview, I heard you talking about the assassination, or I guess the official story wasn't that he was assassinated, but that he died of cancer. What was it? It was, I forget it was, but it was an accident. Bob Marley, I'm talking about. Didn't they say that he like hurt his toe or something, and then he ended up in the hospital and then died? It was like a really bizarre thing that happened, but
I can tell you the details.
Okay, go ahead.
The thing with Bob Marley was that he was not a pot-smoking, you know, no-brainer. This guy was super intelligent, and he was becoming a major power, I tell you, global power, because so many were listening to his words, and his words was like, unite, you know, let's become free,
right.
stop the nonsense, and don't listen to them anymore, these type of messages. And in 75, Kissinger and some of these rogue elements using parts of Operation 40 went into Jamaica to try and destabilize the country, and it went as far as pronouncing martial law on the island and so on, because they were pumping in weapons, they were doing all, you know, burning crops, they were blowing up buildings, they were doing all type of things. And it came to a point where Bob Marley agreed to be part of a, like a peace concert, you know, where both the leaders of the major parties on the island were invited. And just before, when they were rehearsing for this party, and many people warned him, my God, if you go up there, they're going to kill you, you're going to be assassinated. But he was totally determined to do it. And just, I think it was a few days before the concert, an armed group went up, and they were in the kitchen, Bob Marley, his wife, his manager, they were just standing around chatting, and somebody just pulled the door open and started firing inside the kitchen. His wife was hit in the back of the head. His manager was hit 4 times in the stomach, I think. And Bob was touched his chest, and then the bullet lodged in his left arm. So by a miracle he survived. I mean. Anyway, it seems like one of the guy that was the boss of this operation was a man by the name of Guillermo Posada, Carriles Posada, who was also part of Operation 40, and later involved in hundreds of terror acts, and pardoned by no one less than George Bush Sr. I mean,
oh, wow.
Surprise, surprise. one of the people in Operation 40, by the way, has a statue in Miami. I mean, and another one has, his name was Orlando Bosch. He did hundreds of bomb attacks. He blew up airliners and all of these type of things, pardoned by George Bush Sr. And now he has his own day in Miami, as far as I know, like a holiday, the Orlando Bosch Day. So, unreal.
Yeah, huh.
But when it comes to Bob Marley, he was, after that, he went up, and even though he was wounded, he did the concert, and he got the two leaders from these two parties to come up on stage and shake hands, you know, unreal. It was fantastic what happened there. But at the same time, I think the elite saw that this guy is unstoppable, you know, we can't scare him up, we need to stop him. So just a few days later, a documentary film from Los Angeles, his name is Peter Colby. He came forward and approached Bob Marley, saying that we would very much like if you could make a documentary and so on. And by the way, here is a pair of boots, just as a little present, because Bob Marley was very much into jeans, cowboy boots, keeping himself fit and so on. And so Bob was really, he was really happy. And there's this famous photographer, I think he's called Liu Liu or something like that, from Los Angeles, who was there when this happened. So he said that when Bob pulled on one of the boots, he just shouted out, you know, in pain, ow, ow, like this, pulled off the boot, And inside the boot, there was a piece of a copper wire that had punctured his big toe. This is the exact toe that he later developed cancer in. This is the toe that you heard of when a year or so down the road, when somebody stepped on it, it just more or less exploded. And this is the cancer that spread and killed him. You know. And Peter Colby, not only was he one of the witnesses in the O.J. Simpson case, because he was the neighbor of Simpson's wife, former wife, but he's also the son of the former CIA director, Bill Colby, that was later found dead, you know, drowned, and so central in so many of these things. So what are the chances? I mean, I'm not saying that he knew. I'm not pointing at him saying that he killed Bob Marley. I'm saying that he was maybe manipulated into handing over this gift that had been prepared, you know. And I also think, because some people say, yeah, but how come, why didn't he die for another 5-6 years? Because he died just a few months after John Lennon. But if you do a lot of research in, when it comes to cancer and the power of hemp oil and also marijuana, when it comes to cancer treatment and so them being extremely efficient, that could be one of the reasons why he kept himself alive for such a long time, because he was smoking a lot and he managed to keep the cancer under control. But this was a very, very vicious form of cancer. So also he was approached later on in the final stage of his disease by a former German doctor with a very Nazi roots, you know, from the Second World War. He approached him. I mean, how big are the chances of a Nazi doctor to say to a Rastafari man that I'll do my best to help you? I mean, it doesn't really make sense. And according to Bob Marley's mother, if what I found out is true, she said that he was treated extremely badly, you know, almost being tortured with all these different injections and you know, they cut his hair off and they didn't feed him anything, and he was just in absolute agony when he died.
Oh my God.
Once again, awful, awful.
You know, doing your research, you must come across a lot of like darkness, you know, in humanity. And but you seem to be very light-hearted. You're not like you don't seem bitter or angry or you know, what do you do in your spare time when you're not researching to keep things in balance? Yeah.
I tell you, it's taken 30 years to get to this point, because I used to be very scared, then I was paranoid.
Were you that guy that lived in the hole? That was you?
No, but it's like you go through different stages, and I think most people that are waking up to this, what is going on, you know, it's almost like when you lose somebody you love,
yeah.
You go into like a stage first of shock, my God, this cannot be true. Then you go into incredible sadness.
Yeah.
Then you go into anger.
Yeah.
It can, you know, you get furious. Then you go into, you start telling anyone around you, and they can't bear listening to you. I mean, it's just, please, can somebody shut this person up? Because what you spread out.
Sorry.
We've all been there. I mean, you can just see in what stage are you, you know.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, like I say, I lost dear friends, I had to move country, I've been totally shit scared from time to time, you know, they've been after me as well, so, and I'm putting myself in the line of fire now, I tell you, big time. So it's not a game for wimps. At the same time, I've leveled out, I would say, and now I see it from a point of love. I always try to come from the direction of love. And I'm not saying that as love as I fancy you, baby, if you're nice to me, that type of love, but love as the highest of frequencies, you know, because this is, when you look in a laboratory, the thing that we have labeled true love is a frequency that is higher than the frequency of thought. So this is not like a new age, wee-oo-wee-oo type of thing. It is real. And the lowest form of frequency that we have in this universe that we can experience is what's called pure terror, you know, fear, fear, fear.
Yeah.
And the thing is, when you let these two, if you let a frequency, a high frequency and a low frequency meet in a laboratory, what happens is really amazing, because is not that the two starts fighting in the middle, you know, and then come out, you know, one a little bit stronger than the other. No, the lower one just totally gets annulled. Woof, it just disappears, just like when you turn on the light in a dark window, in a dark room. It's not like the shadows are just hanging on saying, I'm not going, I'm not going, I'm not going. You just put the light on, boom, it's light. And so my recipe, I would say, and I would be very happy if it could spread, is that people, you know, like Buddha or Muhammad or Jesus, they were super hackers. They cracked the code to this universe. And what they said was, whatever the problem is, meet it with a higher frequency. Whatever the problem is, meet it with love, indirectly, you know. And so this is what I do. If I'm in the line of fire, if I'm being threatened, if I'm being shouted at, or, you know, the only thing I focus on is, I have this word divine, 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 that works for me. I'm not religious in any way, but it just works for me. You know, if somebody's standing shouting at me, threatening me in any way, I just focus on, he's divine, he's divine, he's my brother, he's somebody's son, he's divine, he's somebody's father, you know, like that. And then, when you meet it fearlessly with love, you can't play with these things. You can't sort of act like you're in love. If you are fearful, it doesn't work. But if you can manage to stay in that frequency, often really miraculous things happen. The situation from being very dangerous maybe turns into something beautiful. I don't know how it happens. I just say I've seen it in war zones. I've seen it many, many different places. When you are able to stay in that focus, in that frequency, suddenly, like 2 minutes down the line, this guy who wanted to beat you in the head with something hard, suddenly starts sitting down and, you know, talking about his problems with his wife, or him being out fishing with his boys. Or, you know, there's just this amazing thing. But if you go in fear mode, the risk of you getting hurt is major. So it's so important, you know. So when these things happen, I just focus, love, love. If you shoot me, okay, fine, but love, love, love. I prefer staying here, but love, love, love. And so far, so good. Maybe I'm really thick or naive, or maybe I'm onto something. I just know what works for me.
Yeah, you're onto something.
Thank you. I tell you, when I went out with my book, because I tried to get it published for, 20 odd years, could not get it out there. And then in December 2012, I just decided I'm just going to pump it out over the internet for free, you know, just all over the place, to get it off my shoulder, because it's been labeled like a bomb of truth. There's so much in it that these people do not want to get out there. So I totally lost the thread now, but I pumped it out there, and the response I was afraid of, that this could cause, you know, people committing suicide if they were exposed, you know, or tragedies like that. But instead, I have not had one single negative email. I've had response from all over the world, just people saying, oh my God, you know, now I don't believe in revenge anymore. Now I can see that there's hope, you know, I can see that the world is not crazy anymore. Now I know what to do, you know, because I focus on facing these things fearlessly. I'm not talking about being a wimp or anyway. I mean, this is a heavy duty, you know. These are hard-hitting forces. But to stand up in truth, in transparency, a total exposure. I mean, they know who I am, wherever. I'm not trying to hide. But in love, a total spotlight on them. This is the way to go, and the way to be able to deal with these things, I think, is to raise the energy you have inside. And the best way to raise that energy in whatever situation you are in is with gratitude. Gratitude has this magical way of pumping up your spirit, you know. The more grateful, look around yourself, be grateful for your pillow, be grateful for your bed, be grateful for whatever food you have that day, be grateful for your dad, your mom, your son, look around with grateful eyes, and you can feel the gratitude racing. Because the higher your energy is, the more difficult it is for them to control you, because they are trying to push you down all the time through media, through telling you, the world is awful, the world is a horrible place, it's full of terrorists, there's dangers everywhere. There is not. There is not. It's a, for anyone who's seen The Wizard of Oz, that it's a very, very symbolic picture of what's going on, in my opinion. It's, you've got this little girl who the only thing she wants is to go back home, which is what we're trying to do, to return to the world the way it's supposed to be, in perfect balance, perfect harmony, these things. But the way to go home, she has not been able to see that, and people keep telling her, yeah, but the only one who knows will be the Wizard of Oz. So she approaches this big, magnificent castle where the Wizard of Oz that people fear very much is located, and she brings some of her friends with her as well. So when she enters this this castle, there's this very powerful voice saying, "We're powerful and you're weak, you're weak, you're nothing," like this. But instead of freaking out and running out of there, she's a brave girl, so she does not in any violent way try to get to this person. Instead, the only thing she does is to stand fearlessly and walk forward. So they start looking around in the castle, even though these voices keep on bombarding them, and suddenly they see this cable going in behind a curtain. So they walk over there, and when they pull away the curtain, there's this little old guy with a microphone and a massive big amplifier pumping out this message. "We are powerful, we're powerful, and you are weak, you are weak." And this is exactly what we are experiencing. This is a small, small group. I mean, there are only a couple of thousand in total, I think. And we are 7 billion people. So for them to control us, it's an absolute joke and a disgrace to us. I mean, we have to be ashamed of letting them get away with it for such a long time. I mean, how asleep can we be? Incredible. But this is what is happening now, is that the drape is being pulled and suddenly we see them.
Yeah.
So I would say stay fearless, you know, in see that what seems very scary. I mean, now it's very high tech, so that very few people can control a lot. But at the same time, they depend on us, the normal people. You know, they have their FEMA camps, they have the drones, they have all of these things. But if you take Henry Kissinger and say, "Can you please fly this drone?" He won't have a clue. It takes normal people to become soldiers, to become police officers, to become electricians that take care of the FEMA camps or install toilets or deliver food or whatever. So all of us need to take a very good look in the mirror and see, am I part of this in any way? And if so, is this right? Is there any honor? Is there any value to humanity in what I'm doing? Or is it just a paycheck? And I tell you, this paycheck in the long run can be a very dear one to receive, because if I'm correct, in a not that distant future, this group, the so-called elite that they call themselves, will be looked upon as being the enemy, and anyone who has helped them will be looked upon as traitors. You know, not a nice situation to be in. So I would very strongly advise anyone who see that they are part of this, it's always like always, it's very compartmentalized, so that you are not supposed to be aware of your part. But really, ask your soul, you know, when you're in a FEMA camp and you're sort of installing a new alarm, you must think, it is a pretty weird place, isn't it? I mean, okay, it's high tech, but my God, it really looks like a concentration camp. There are no excuses, you know. The same with people delivering surveillance equipment or looking or you know, listening into Skype conversations like this. I mean, listen, guys, every time I'm on an interview, you're breaking in, you're cutting out, you're shutting down webcams, it's ridiculous, you know. Life is short, it is. And these type of things, come on. So I would say, wake up, take your power back, turn off the box that is pumping you with all this crap. It's done by design, I tell you. It's not me saying that you shouldn't watch these programs, but many of them are done by design to keep you on a low, depressed level, because that's where they can control you.
Right.
I would say turn it off, and after a while you will have this strange feeling inside, and this feeling will be like, my God, I'm starting to feel pretty good. I wonder what's going on. You know, this is unusual. I'm not depressed anymore. I'm not fearful anymore. What's going on? I tell you, watch it. Watch and see it happen. And then in the meantime, take care of your families, your friends, your community. Like JFK said, don't ask what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. And the same thing in all different situations. Choose love. Choose to do good. Be an example, you know. Fearless example. And this will soon end. Happy days.
Well, that was really lovely, and that was a beautiful way for us to wrap up the show because we are out of time here. And I want to remind everybody, your website is lightonconspiracies.com, and they can sign up for your newsletter. You also have a donation button. You're doing a lot of hard work, so I know that you deserve a little help every now and again, or you need a little help every now and again to keep it going. So I hope that everybody looks at your research and your articles and follows you on Facebook and gets involved. So Christine and I would love to have you back on the show because we had so much we wanted to get into, but that we weren't able to. So hopefully in the next week or two we can schedule you back.
Anytime. And would it be okay if I end with a prayer?
Absolutely. Please do.
Like I said, I'm not a religious person. I think most of the time religion is used as a political tool. That is not my way. But I'm a spiritual person, and I think I love this prayer, and it goes like this. May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who heard us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light.
Well, that was beautiful. And that's a really great place to end. So everybody stay with us. We're going to take a short break, and when we get back, Christine and I will close out the show. But we wanted to thank once again Ole. You can find his website at lightonconspiracies.com. Thank you so much, Ole. Have a beautiful rest of your day.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Alright, bye.
Everything I'm looking at seems crazy. The newspaper, the television, nothing's right. Nothing's telling me what's true. It's like I fell into a bucket of cream and kicked my legs until I became a mouse. What's that about? I'm a conspiracy realist, not a conspiracy theorist. I want a t-shirt that represents me. What? There's one that's available? Go to shop.truthatease.com, says the voice in my head. Shop.truthatease.com. It's not crazy. I'm not afraid to go on the internet and go to shop.truthatease.com. I'm not scared. I've taken out bowling balls that look like you. That's what I said. Straighten out. Get your conspiracy realist t-shirt. Don't make me come over there. You look good.
Welcome back. Thanks for listening to Truth or Talk. We just interviewed Ole Damigod of Light on Conspiracies, which you can find at lightonconspiracies.com. So, hey, Christine.
Hey, April. That was a really interesting interview. I had no idea you was at Bilderberg.
Yeah.
Now we have a Bilderberg insider, but
I know.
I just that must have been really interesting.
Yeah, we actually couldn't finish asking him everything we wanted to ask him, so we're going to bring him back on the show for a second interview, because sometimes we get guests on and they have too much, there's so much to talk about that we just feel like it's just incomplete. So we've scheduled a second interview in case you guys just stay tuned for a couple of weeks. We'll air that out and get that in there too. But yeah, I mean, we didn't know, I guess I didn't see that on his website when I was doing the research for this interview, that he had been to Bilderberg and all of that. So it's good to get somebody who has an insight on that, because we've always wanted to, and we've never done a show on it before. The Bilderberg group, these secret societies. So
yeah.
That's essentially what it is. I mean, I don't know exactly. We'll, when we get him on the second time, maybe we'll ask him to get into a little more detail about that, but yeah, I mean, these elite groups, they go in and meet in secret, and they have, and, you know, and then they act like we're supposed to just think it's cool and normal that a bunch of rich people who control the lives of many, and if you think that sounds like it's too much, it's not, because you take Google, for example. How many people work for Google, you know? How many people's livelihoods are dependent upon Google? Many. And then in not only the people that work for them, but the people that use their service, right? So we're all connected to them. So if the head CEO of Google is going to go and meet with a bunch of other rich douchebags, I'm sorry, they're not all, but some of them, but if you go to Bilderberg, like, I question you. And, you know, but if that guy's going to meet with Bill Gates and they're going to meet with Mark Zuckerberg and, you know, who invented, so they say, Facebook. But, I don't even know like, anymore after I've seen all these things where you realize that, you know, Stephen Jobs really didn't invent the Macintosh, and you realize that, you know, Bill Gates really didn't invent Microsoft, and all these people, you go, did Mark Zuckerberg really invent that? I don't know, so I don't mean to be like,
you know, like,
everything's
cynical,
a conspiracy,
yeah.
Cynical, yeah. But it's at the same time, it's like, it's hard not to imagine that, because I throw Mark Zuckerberg out there. I'm going to use this spying tool real quick and look and see if he's been to Bilderberg. I feel like he has. But I'm saying that, and I'm not sure. So,
But go on.
He was at Bilderberg in 2012.
Big surprise.
But I'm just saying, when these people get together, and they control the media, and they control the social media, and they control the lives of those who work for them. They have many, many, many employees. Those people feed their families because of the existence of this corporation. Then how can it not be a little questionable that they meet together in secret? Do you know? It's like, how you're controlling so much, and I don't know. But
kind of like the other day, I was looking at this guy interview this. He was interviewing somebody that funded a medical study. Oh, it was. It was the documentary talking about the electromagnetic frequencies. And did you see that?
No.
Anyway, they were talking about that the telephone companies and electronic companies fund the studies that say that there's no that EMFs are safe for people.
Well, right.
Yeah, you know, and I'm just basically like, well, and even one of the guys asked the head of marketing, he was like, well, isn't that a conflict of interest?
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, well, there was a potential conflict of interest. I'm like, no, motherfucker, you know that there's a huge conflict of interest.
Right.
You know, but it's interesting how he used his words, but I'm like, you're a liar, you know, come on, right?
Right.
Why would you fund a study, like, you know, that, anyway.
It's that way across the board, though, right?
Yeah.
We see that time and time again with the vaccine industry. It's the same thing. That's who funds the study for the safety studies on vaccines. That's who funds
the
studies
pharmaceutical companies.
the pharmaceutical companies, you know, the vaccine manufacturers. That's who does it. Mm. And so it's like, of course they're buying. It's the same tobacco science over and over and over again. You know, the cigarette industry for years and years and years were the ones funding their safety studies, right? So then they could say, well, we can conclude that it doesn't cause cancer. For years and years and years they said that. You know, even though people were dying right in front of them and winning lawsuits that they could, saying that they died from smoking their cigarettes, you know. I don't know if all tobacco smoke, I've actually heard recently that it's not necessarily tobacco smoke that makes people sick. It's just how the cigarettes are manufactured. So I haven't delved into that enough, but I'm kind of curious as to why that is, because it does kind of make sense, because tobacco is a leaf just like hemp or marijuana.
Well, the smoking and Batari can mess with your lungs, but they also put additives in cigarettes like urine and fiberglass and... You know,
right,
I've read that
exactly.
little bitty pieces of fiberglass, when you inhale them, they, like, make holes in your lungs, so it makes it even more addictive. It's for some reason the reaction with the fact that it has in your lungs, and then you're smoking the tobacco, makes you more addicted, become more addicted to the tobacco.
Right. Yeah, exactly. They haven't, they have something in there that causes it to become more addicting. But I think like tobacco smoking, what some of these people are saying is that it's no more so dangerous than smoking marijuana, because in that case,
yeah.
you know, smoke will always put tar into your lungs, just even if you breathe it. Yeah. If somebody's barbecuing next door, I mean, you know, those kinds of things is gonna happen. But I think they're saying it's not any worse. But I don't know. I haven't looked into it, so I can't speak on that for sure. But
I guess what I'm trying to say is the additive. They're bad, but they do that to help make people more addicted, so they buy more cigarettes, right? And then
yeah.
they come with studies saying that cigarettes aren't bad or safe, or I mean, you know, but they're funded by tobacco companies, like, you know, it's
yeah, and as we see the same shit right now with the vaccine industry and the pharmaceutical industry and all that, you know, that it's the same people that are doing the study. So how can they really truly be biased? And like with what we were talking with Ole about, I mean, you know, all these assassinations, the forensic research and the studies and on who did the, I mean, it's all by the people who probably are in the intelligence community, the ones who are actually controlling these assassinations, you know, if the CIA is funding it, or if they're the ones that are actually factions of the FBI are actually performing the investigation. It's like, well, really? Do they want to indict themselves? I doubt it, you know?
It's so funny. No, but when you brought that up, I was talking the other day about to the children that I teach about corrupt policemen. And we just, basically, you know, when I say people are people, so there's going to be good people and bad people no matter what profession. So I'm not teaching them all policemen are bad, but I was like, you know, in this case, I'm like, you know, I was saying, you know, not all cops are bad. Some are good, some are bad, but they're people. And this girl was like, what? They're bad cops?
Oh, wow.
Well, she's a kid, you know? And I was like, well, yeah, you know? She goes, well, do the other cops tell on them if they're bad?
Aww.
I know.
Like, I would, yeah.
I know, but yeah, I was like, not really. It should be that way.
But it's not. Right. You know, and I mean, and we can get into all the myriad of reasons why they wouldn't. You know, sometimes it's because they're corrupt too. Sometimes it's because they're just afraid. You know, so.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I lost the call.
Oh, you're back though.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
But yeah, I mean, that's an innocent child, you know, making a comment like that, which is cute. And
yeah.
You don't want them to hate all cops
yeah.
because, you know, gosh. Forbid they would ever be in a situation where they would need help.
Yeah.
You don't want them to be afraid to, like, go up and ask a cop. But at the same time, you know, I mean...
People are people, like the song.
Exactly.
That's what everybody needs to get. Like, I look at, you know, I look at war and, you know, when people, you know, people talk about other countries that maybe that they're detached from and they'll say things like, well, that's, you know, who cares? That's not me. Like, a group of people need to be killed, you know?
Right.
It's like these people don't have wishes and hopes and desires and dreams and love their children, you know? Just like anybody else. They're people, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But a lot of people don't...
Well, they do. I mean, everybody's kind of, you know, in a, what would you call it? Like, these authority figures are deities or, you know,
yeah.
godlike, as we've done our shows recently talking about the religions and how these things become religions. These people become like their priests or their preachers or their, you know, their gods, and whether it be in law enforcement or, you know, anything, and the science and medical industry and so on and so forth, you know, people don't question them because they think that they are godlike, or they're beyond reproach, you know, they're like, we see that in the church, too. I mean, you know, they don't question the priest for molesting the kids, because they're godlike, you know, they're the step below the God, or who they think is God, and so, but not us, that's not what we do around here. Around here, Truth or Dog, this is our job to question these people and to bring light to it, and hopefully give everybody inspiration and hope to that we can actually overcome it and find, you know, a little bit of freedom and a happiness in our lives. I hope that's what we can help put out.
Yeah, I'm not really about that. So
that's aight. Yeah. You know, freedom's okay. Living a healthy long life is just aight.
It's all right.
But it's just okay. Whatever.
It's
everything. So
everything. I'm totally kidding. I'm just being
goofy. Yeah, of course it is. So but yeah, these guys you know, they're all in some secret society, cabal, or whatever. And it's interesting, I brought up Mark Zuckerberg, who is the founder of Facebook, or created Facebook, so goes the official story, who knows. But anyway, I have no reason to believe that he didn't. You know, did you ever see The Social Network?
Yes. Kind of, it seems like the same thing that happened with, like, Steve Jobs.
Well, but in that one, though, they did show that he actually did mastermind. Like, he did have the ability. Because Steve Jobs didn't actually even have the computer science ability. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had some. He wasn't, you know, completely unable to do it, but he
not like his
mostly, but his friends were much better at it. And then he actually he relied on them to do it. Whereas Zuckerberg was the big nerd. Like, he knew how to do it. And, was really, really smart in that way, but he also was very, like, into himself and narcissistic, yes, yeah, and kind of a prick, you know, and did sort of backstabbed his friend who'd helped him, and his friend wasn't necessarily, according to this film, The Social Network, I kind of enjoyed this movie, I thought it was pretty good, pretty well written.
Yeah, it was.
But it was good, right? Yeah, it was interesting.
The first line that was the greatest, he's having the conversation with the girl that he's dating, and she finds out how shallow and just selfish he is, and then she says, you know, you're going to spend the rest of your days thinking that people are going to hate you because you're a nerd, but they're not going to hate you because you're a nerd, they're going to hate you because you're an asshole. Maybe I'm paraphrasing, but I was like, that's the best!
That was a great line, because it was really true.
Yeah, because I've run into guys like that who have, and I still have known some people from time to time, you know, as an adult, that like kind of have that bitterness about, like, oh, I'm a nerd, you know, people don't like me, people don't like me because I'm just so smart, and I'm just so smarter than everybody else, and, you know, nobody likes me, and they're jealous of me, because I'm so smart, you know?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's because you're a fucking asshole. There are people that are smart, and they have people skills. And they're, you know, that's another type of intelligence that's not really acknowledged. And actually, most people that are successful have better emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
You know, really high emotional intelligence, you know. They have to be able to be outgoing and anyway.
No, you're absolutely right. And I've known people like that too, you know, who think that that it's just because they're smart that you don't like them, but then, or, you know, you're, you just don't get it, or you can't take it, or whatever. But but that, you know, and that's what his type of character. And so she calls him out in the beginning of the movie. And I don't know if I'm sure there was some embellishment in that, you know, that it wasn't a documentary or anything. It was a film that was fiction. But I guess, like, there was a moment where he was writing in his blog, and he called some girl a bitch, and that was the girl that that character was based on. So he had some girl, you know, piss him off, and then he got mad, and so he called her a bitch, and so he invented Facebook, and that's the official story of it. I don't really know how it goes down, but it's just interesting, because this guy went to Harvard, and there's a secret society out of Harvard, the Skull and Bones Society. So, I mean, I don't know if he was in Skull and Bones, but he definitely have, you know.
He was in Bilderberg.
He was definitely in Bilderberg. So there's some, but I don't know if Zuckerberg was in Skull and Bones. I think some of the famous Skull and Bonesers are like the Bushes and Al Gore.
John Kerry, right? I've heard.
Yeah. So some of these guys are Skull and Bonesers. They go to Harvard, and they get in on all that. So anyway, so people are people, and we're just about out of time here. But we want to thank everybody for checking us out and listening today. Our guest is Ole Damagord, Light on Conspiracies at lightonconspiracies.com. So please check his stuff out, sign up for his newsletter, and until next time, peace, truth, and love, y'all.
Peace, truth, love you guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Excuse me.
It's our future.
On September the 18th, 1970, the world learned that one of history's greatest guitarists was dead. Monica Daneman told the inquest into Jimmy's death, "Jimmy slept well on Tuesday and Wednesday night. I don't know about Thursday night. We arrived home at 8:30, I cooked a meal, and we had a bottle of white wine about 11 p.m. Had nothing to drink apart from the wine. I had a bath and washed my hair, and then we talked. There was no argument or stress, no unhappy atmosphere. I took a sleeping tablet about 7 a.m. I made him two tuna fish sandwiches and we were in bed talking. I woke about 10:20 a.m. He was sleeping normally. I went to get cigarettes and when I came back, I got back into bed. He was breathing and his pulse was normal, but I could not wake him.
Jimmy. 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 Jimmy! Oh, fucking hell. Jimmy! Hi. It's me. It's Jimmy. I can't wake him up. I'm scared that if I call an ambulance, he'll get cross with me when he wakes up.
There were nine of my sleeping tablets missing.
Jimmy!
When I saw him before he went to sleep, he was very happy. The ambulance didn't arrive until 11:30. And the ambulance men reassured me that Jimmy would be all right.
I can't wake him. What's wrong with him? Please tell me what's wrong with him. He won't move, he won't respond. Jimmy, come on, what's wrong?
Was he drinking? Don't worry.
No, he hasn't been drinking anything. We had some white wine with dinner and that was it.
Don't worry, darling.
Get in there as soon as you can.
Can you
tell me what's wrong with him?
Well, we'll find that out.
He's not going to die,
worry,
is he?
Don't worry.
He's not going to die.
Okay, one,
be careful,
two,
careful with him.
Three.
Careful with him.
Okay.
Oh, my, Jimmy. He is going to live, isn't he?
Yes.
Can I come with you? Okay, how long? I'll be 1 minute. He is going to live, isn't he?
Yeah, don't worry about it. We'll just take him down to the local hospital.
Can I come with you?
Yes. Get dressed quickly, though.
Get dressed.
Okay. You just look after him, all right? Jimmy, oh, don't worry, babe. I'm going to be with you soon.
I travelled with Jimmy in the ambulance all the way to the hospital and waited in the car park for news.
Get his head up. Get the mask on him.
Okay, we need some oxygen.
All right. Come on, Jimmy. Come on, wake up. Come on, get his head up.
Get his head up.
Okay, he's got a weak pulse.
A nurse came to speak to me and told me that Jimmy was in bad shape. She did, however, say that a medical team hoped they could save him.
His lungs collapsed, but there is still a chance that we can save him.
Okay, people started.
What's happening?
People started. People.
Come on, people, speak to me. Tell me what's going on.
Okay, his pulse is getting weaker. We need some more oxygen.
Come on, Jimmy. Wake up. We're losing him.
Come on, we're going to lose him.
Come on, what's happening?
Come on, where's his pulse?
Come on, what's happening?
Get some more oxygen to him now. Come on, we're going to lose this guy. Come on.
Come on, Jimmy.
Okay,
we're losing him. We need more pressure. We need more pressure now.
Blood pressure's gone.
Stop. He's dead.
There's no pulse. There's no pulse.
Are you going to call it?
Time of death.
Despite the doctors working furiously to resuscitate him, Jimmy's life could not be saved. The news of Jimmy's death was broken to me by a nurse in the car park. It was only when I saw Jimmy's dead body that I could believe he'd passed away. The headlines screamed that Hendrix had died the typical rock star death, a drugs overdose amid fame, opulence, and decadence. The inquest found that Jimmy had died from inhaling his own vomit after taking Monica's barbiturate sleeping tablets. The inquest accepted completely Monica's story, but left an open verdict, which meant that the actual circumstances of the death could not be determined. Monica was the only witness called. None of the medical team or ambulance men were consulted. After Jimmy's death, rumours abounded. One had him overdosing on heroin at a friend's flat and his body taken and placed in Monica's flat. Another had him flown to Hollywood, murdered, and flown back on a private jet. And yet another rumour had him die at a famous rock star's apartment with Devon by his side. However, 22 years later, Steve Roby and Kathy Etchingham traced the ambulance men, Reg Jones and John Sewer. They insist Dannemann was not at the flat when they arrived and that Hendrix was already dead.
His mixed membranes all black. Been dead for about 4 or 5 hours.
But it's him.
And if Monica Dannemann is to be believed about what happened on their last night together, why was Hendrix fully dressed? And how could the ambulance men possibly miss seeing someone who was supposed to be there? In other words, Monica. The ambulance men also contradicted Monica when they both asserted that no one, apart from themselves, had travelled to the hospital with Hendrix.
Well, there's no pulse. I think this one's gone, actually.
Equally, Dr. Bannister, the then surgical registrar, stated that Hendrix had been dead for at least 7 hours when he was admitted to the hospital. Dr. Bannister noted that Hendrix's lungs were filled with vomit and masses of red wine.
Somebody take this away.
Let's have a look.
I'd say, if we can close these curtains.
You put him into the recovery position.
They'd never before seen a man who drowned in his own red wine.
You call it. See you later.
Time of death.
So how did the red wine get into Jimmy's lungs? The 60s and 70s were turbulent political times, and now compelling evidence has emerged that points to a sinister coalition between the United States government and organized crime, set up specifically to murder prominent leaders of the new youth culture, including rock musicians.
Jimi Hendrix was killed for two reasons. First of all, he had made statements in the teen press calling for the Black Panthers to go to Washington, D.C. and shoot the place up. Secondly, he had done a benefit for Bobby Seale and the Chicago 8. And that got the attention of the FBI and a program called COINTELPRO, which was a surveillance and assassination program. And it led to the murder of 28 Black Panthers. Tupac Shakur makes 29 because he was a Black Panther. Hendrix linked up with the Black Panthers, and for that reason, he was a dead man.
COINTELPRO was fostered by J. Edgar Hoover, the chief of the FBI for a very long time, in the late 1950s. And the original goal of the program was to eliminate, in their words, neutralize or defame any kind of young, in Hoover's exact words, messianic black leader who could galvanize all parts of the civil rights movements, black nationalist movements, and white sympathizers, white liberal sympathizers, okay, and get them going into a very progressive, powerful movement.
The first clues that Hendrix was a government target emerged from declassified FBI files.
In 1976, there were a group of students at Santa Barbara University of California who put in for FOIA documents on Jimi Hendrix. They got 6 heavily blacked out pages. They appealed, they got 7 more pages, and they learned from those documents that Jimi Hendrix had been put on a security index established by the FBI to have him and everyone else on that index rounded up and placed in detainment camps in the account of a national emergency.
Another interesting thing about the FBI files in this particular case is that they're in national security terms redacted, which means blacked out or censored. Okay, so that very much crucial information, you know, is still not available to the public. As somebody who's fished through these files for 7 or 8, 9, 10 years, you know, it's usually the most interesting, the most sensitive stuff, okay, that gets blacked out. That's the stuff that they really don't want you to know, that puts them in a very much compromised kind.